I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education, and I'm happy to welcome you to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. Those of you who follow our series know that we only have one left. I know. Thank you. That was a good response. Next week, Ben Jones will be here in conjunction with Focus Ben Jones, and put the word out that if you want some insight into the exhibition that opens the following weekend, if you want to know first, be at the Tuesday evening lecture next Tuesday. I also hope that everybody saw that the Art Lies reading group is still open and that you could sign up tonight. I announced that last week. I believe that Erin is here, and she could answer questions maybe on the way out if you have any. Otherwise, you can contact her here at the museum. Tomorrow, we begin a four-week lecture series, Andy Warhol and His Legacy, with the Kay and Velma Kimball Chair of Art History at TCU, Dr. Mark Thistlethwaite. I know that you all know Mark, and I don't have to encourage you to be here because I know if you're available, you will be. The lectures are part actually of his art history course at TCU, and he's just agreed to hold the last four lectures here at the museum, and the Modern is happy to offer those free to the public. So I encourage you to come. The lectures are at 4 p.m. on Wednesdays through April 21st, each pertaining to a different topic concerning Warhol, as indicated by the title and descriptions listed on the museum's website. Also on the website is a list of artists participating in Sundays with Andy. This Sunday, Ed Blackburn has graciously agreed to give a tour on Easter, which I have to say, I think being on Easter provides a certain kind of material for the tour, given Andy Warhol's late work. So if you're available, show up. I think that that could be a really interesting one. Of course, Ed will do a great job. He is one of the most sincere people and artists I know. Tonight, I have a feeling we are going to gain great new insight into the work of possibly the most important and surely most elusive artist of the 20th century, because poet and conceptual artist Kenneth Goldsmith is here to expand our current exhibition's presentation, Andy Warhol's Last Decade, or Andy Warhol, The Last Decade. And preparing to introduce Kenneth's lecture, which is titled The Hyperlinked Warhol, The Artist as King of Media, I was reminded that Kenneth needs to be here to talk about his own vast and impressive career. Thanks to Wikipedia entry by Kenneth's students at University of Pennsylvania, where he teaches poetics and poetic practice, I learned that Kenneth received a BFA in sculpture from RISD and worked for some time as a text-based artist before becoming a poet and writer. And it's as a poet and writer that I know him, so I was kind of surprised and delighted to find out that, in fact, he began as a sculptor and text-based artist. He has published 9 books of poetry, including Fidget, which the Whitney Museum of American Art commissioned vocalist Theo Blackman to stage an interpretation of in 1998. There is also his American trilogy, The Weather, Traffic, and Sports, the last of which was published in 2008. Publishers Weekly called Kenneth's writing some of the most exhaustive and beautiful collage work yet produced in poetry. Simon Morris produced a documentary on Kenneth's work titled Kenneth Goldsmith Sucking on Words in 2007 that premiered at the Eccles Center at the British Library, in which and in this video, or this DVD, on this DVD, fellow poet Christian Bach refers to him as our James Joyce for the 21st century. I have to say that I've seen the DVD, and it is very much the worth the hour spent. It's delightful. Kenneth is both funny and profound. In April of 2009, Kenneth organized an evening of contemporary poetry at the Whitney in conjunction with Jenny Holzer's retrospective, and he curated and participated in the Serpentine Gallery's 24-hour poetry marathon this past October. And I would be amiss if I didn't mention that we have Kenneth to thank for the incredible online archive Ubu Web, for which he received the Owerts Electronic Music Award in Paris last April. In addition, by all accounts, Kenneth is an incredible teacher, receiving the Answich Distinguished Fellow Professorship in American Studies at Princeton University this year. So I don't quite know how he's doing it all. He's teaching at University of Pennsylvania and Princeton and maintaining his own practice. There is more, but I believe that I have soundly established that we obviously have to schedule Kenneth to come back. Nevertheless, my invitation for Kenneth to speak on Warhol is also obvious. He has studied the life and work of Andy Warhol extensively, knowing that this subject is, in fact, unknowable. Kenneth is the editor of I'll Be Your Mirror, the selected Andy Warhol interviews, which is a wonderful look at Warhol's role in critiquing and dismantling the interview process by telling more with his seemingly evasive responses as interviewee and seemingly trivial inquiries as interviewer than most of his forthright counterparts. And that book is available in the museum bookstore. These interviews became the basis of Trans Warhol Chamber Opera, which premiered in Geneva and for which Kenneth wrote the libretto and performed. Thanks to his knowledge of Warhol, we are certainly not his first venue on the subject. He was invited in 2008 to give a talk at Dia Beacon on Warhol as part of the Dia's ongoing lecture series, and I was actually introduced to Kenneth last year when he was on a panel for the TCU Fort Worth Contemporaries exhibition, Warhol, the Shared Subject. Some of you, I think, were present at that panel. But perhaps my biggest incentive for was a conversation about uncreativity as creative process, a preoccupation for Kenneth and a concept he pursues in his writing and his teaching. Through that conversation, it occurred to me that Kenneth's own work seems slightly informed by a Warholian perspective. And it is that insight that made me think he had to have something compelling and unique to offer us on the subject. So if you would, please join me in welcoming Kenneth Goldsmith.
Okay. Thank you, Terry, so much for that amazing introduction, and thank you again for having me. I'm so glad to be back here in Fort Worth. I adore this town. I wanted to actually say about the Easter lecture that's going to go on here is that Warhol was a devout Catholic his entire life and went to church every Sunday, but not to pray to God, but to pray for money. And that's true. He was... okay. I'm going to speak for about 45 minutes. We'll look at a lot of, clips of video. It is the hyperlinked Warhol. And in this paper, or in this lecture, I want to really try to make connections for you between not so much the paintings, but Warhol as a spirit, as a dematerialized spirit who infuses our networked life as it was, and something that's really not very well represented in any exhibition of Warhol. Okay, so for all intents and purposes, Andy Warhol, as an artist, ceased to exist for the last decade in his life. In art historical circles, he was literally written out of history. He was a joke. He was a sellout. He was a has-been for a man who spent his whole life claiming to want to vanish. Such an ambition was ultimately fulfilled in an enormous 1979 exhibition at the Whitney entitled Andy Warhol, Portraits of the 70s, and which included these types of portraits of Truman Capote, Diane von Furstenberg, Yves Saint Laurent, of course, Mick Jagger, was panned by critics who scorned his use of decorator colors, referring to him as a court painter of the international jet set. One prominent critic blasted the show, accusing Warhol of passionate avarice, fame love, and workaholism. A decade later, with his sweeping MoMA retrospective mounted in 1989, Just 2 months after his death, critics were no more forgiving. Robert Hughes, writing in Time magazine, shredded him. He said Warhol had about five remarkable years between 1962 and 1967, followed by a long downhill slide into money-making banality with his social portraits and his silkscreen editions of Dogs, Famous Jews of the 20th Century, and Mercedes. Warhol began and ended as a commercial illustrator. What lies in between is the interesting stuff. Even his later images, which we see up here, of foreboding and death like the skulls, are trashily melodramatic by comparison with what had gone before, while his inflated recyclings of Raphael's Sistine Madonna and Leonardo's Last Supper could scarcely be more pointless. In the end, he was stranded in a plentitude of subjects with nothing to paint. That's Robert Hughes writing in 1989. And to this day, it continues on the epic four-hour 2006 PBS American Masters documentary I'm sure that many of you saw, directed by Rick Burns. A mere 10 minutes out of 4 hours was given to Warhol's last 18 years of work, from 1969, the year he was shot, to the end of his life. In 1987, he was given a mere 10 minutes. Burns treated Warhol as if he had died after his shooting, and that is quite a write-off. Yet a historical reevaluation is afoot, and it's taken a sea change in culture driven by the new attitudes, as I was saying, of the digital, for us to begin to appreciate the full spectrum, and a very important point, full spectrum of Warhol's activity, seen through the lens of, look at Warhol through the lens of social networking, fast user-initiated dissemination of information, embedded advertising, the rapid rise of the celebrity machine, and of course its equally rapid fall, reality television, but to name a few. Warhol's activities suddenly appear to be part and parcel of what we all do today. So full spectrum is the key, the Robert Hughes slam that I just read from, which was so typical of its day, and as I said, continues today, is flawed because it only considers Warhol as a painter, reducing a wildly complex artist to a one-dimensional cardboard cutout, though I think Andy would somehow have adored being called a one-dimensional cardboard cutout. it's complicated. If Hughes had put the paintings in the context of all his other activities, his filmmaking, his magazine publishing, his book writing, his television appearances, his involvement in the worlds of fashion, cable television, media, advertising, archiving, nightclubbing, technology, Polaroids, and so forth, he might have had a very different opinion of that retrospective. But he didn't. And in all fairness, he really couldn't have, because such activities had never been part of an artist's oeuvre. We don't know what to do with these when it comes to the museum. It's actually the same problem here in the museum today. How do you deal with this? And Warhol himself was of no help. He never claimed what he was doing as art, and that leaves us with a sizable revisionist task at hand nearly a quarter of a century after his death. And clearly, the MoMA was also to blame. With the exception of his films, none of these activities were represented in the MoMA retrospective in 1989. I feel like I'm echoing. Maybe it's that thing. I'm sorry. Okay. 25 years ago, when Warhol died, the divide between art and popular culture, in spite of the triumph of pop, was still sizable. Now, today we don't think twice when we see people like Takashi Murakami designing handbags for Louis Vuitton, or Richard Phillips' paintings on the set of Gossip Girl. Jeff Koons, posing here with Stephanie Seymour. He's a regular on the morning talk show circuits. And here's Patti Smith, recently in the Times, posing in Dior. She says, Patti Smith wearing Dior says she loves ball gowns for their cut and their architecture. You know, she also, in that article, she's also pimping for Anne de Muehlmeister. We see Vanessa Beecroft's living nude fashion mannequins strewn across museums worldwide. The wonderful artist Caleb Lindsay, black drag queen, appears in this promotional video still, produced by Prasina Schuller. Maurizio Catalan has his own magazine, Purple, and Peter Halley has his own magazine, Index, which was very much modeled on Warhol's interview. And of course, Julian Schnabel is an Oscar-nominated Hollywood director and real estate developer as well, and restaurateur and interior designer. Whitney Biennial artists make T-shirts for The Gap, and everyone from Kerouac to Steve McQueen have been recast as wearing khakis. Business as art, business as usual. Easy for us to say now, but while he was working, while Warhol was working, only sellouts like Peter Max would appear on covers of magazines or somebody like there. I remember, and I couldn't find an image of it, but I got this wonderful image of a Leroy Neiman. This is called The 18th at Pebble Beach. And there were, I remember this image of Leroy Neiman posing for a Scotch ad with his big handlebar mustache in front of one of these paintings as, representing the good life. Okay? So it was just something that real artists didn't do. But this all changed after Warhol, but it was really too late for him. So what I'd like to do tonight is keep that revisionism in motion by proposing a more contemporary way. I don't know if we want to really continue to look at, let's look at this image instead. I mean, I could keep this up if you... It is relaxing. This is better. So what Warhol loved Leroy Neiman. He actually, this is also where it gets complicated. He worshipped Leroy Neiman. Andrew Wyeth was his dear friend. He hung out with these cheese balls because he loved them, because they had connection to money. And anybody that had connection to money, Warhol was interested in. As a matter of fact, one of Warhol's great dreams was to get a commission for a despot, dictator. This is why he began hanging around with Imelda Marcos and the Shah of Iran, because he figured if he could get that gig, every house would have to have the dictator's portrait, every schoolroom, every church, every museum, and he'd be a zillionaire many times over. So he just couldn't care about politics. He was only after the bucks. So anyway, I want to just kind of keep this revision in motion by proposing a more contemporary telling of the Warhol tale, one that says that his appearing in television ads is every bit as Warholian as his painting. I'd like to demonstrate that the entirety of his life and activities is best viewed as a performance and a real lifelong investigation in what it means to be pop, what it means to live as pop. I'd like to propose that we view Warhol's career not like Robert Hughes, but we view it through a horizontal lens rather than a vertical and hierarchical one. For if anything, Warhol was about flattening and leveling experience. A world without judgment, everything is art, everything is good, everything is easy. We can propose a radical democratization, of what art and what art making could be, and in fact really has become. Now, a caveat, you're seeing it already, that every facet of Warhol is so complicated, and when you say one thing about him, it really means the other. That everything can be read through everything else. So what I want to do in this limited time is really just give you an encapsulated version, at times oversimplified, because if we were really to get into this, we'd never get anywhere, because Warhol left these purposely complex breadcrumbs to stumble us and trip us up the way that I am getting tripped up right now. In many ways, Warhol's critical reception during the last decade of his life was his own fault. From the beginning of his career, once he achieved success in the art world, he worked as hard as he could to distance himself from the art world. He realized early on that the art world was ultimately too small a stage for his idea of what being an artist was. And yet, in typically, here we go, contradictory fashion, he never left the art world. He professed not to care. In a 1966 interview, he said, "I still care about people, but it would be so much easier not to care. It's too hard to care. I don't want to get involved in other people's lives." Of course, he was involved in the superstars' lives. lives and everybody's lives. He said, I don't want to get too close. I don't like to touch things. That's why my work is so distant from myself. And so what did he do? He adopted a fantasy persona, which, like a Hollywood star, enabled him to keep that distance. And his last interview in 1987, he just kept this up his whole life. The interviewer said, Andy, if you were starting out now, would you do anything differently? And Warhol said, I don't know. I just worked hard. It's all fantasy. And the interviewer says, life is fantasy. And Warhol says, yes, it is. So while other artists were working squarely within the tradition of being Western intellectuals, Warhol, again, took his cues from Hollywood stars, game shows, celebrity culture, and he confounded everybody, critics and observers alike. And so, early on, as early as 1962, the performance of being Andy Warhol had begun. So what I'd like to do now is contrast two interviews from the mid-60s, one with Roy Lichtenstein and the other with Warhol from the same period. We'll just watch a couple of minutes of this Roy Lichtenstein interview from 1966.
Of our society, and it's one of the facets of the present society which is new, and one of the facets that hasn't existed before. But it's made, in a way, partially a new landscape for us in the way of billboards and neon signs and all of the stuff that we're very familiar with, and also literature and television, radio. So that almost all of the landscape, all of our environment seems to be made up partially of a desire to sell products. This is the landscape that I'm interested in portraying, and I'm also not only portraying it, but I'm working in the style of it, or a style which at least parodies the style of everyday art and everyday society. I'm interested in portraying a sort of anti-sensibility that pervades the society, and a kind of maybe gross oversimplification. I use that more as style than as actuality. I really don't think that art can be gross and oversimplified and remain art. I mean, it must have subtleties, and it must sort of yield to a kind of aesthetic unity. Otherwise, it's not in the realm of art. It's something else, probably. But
okay. It's amazing. He's charming. He's handsome. He's articulate. He's affable. He's logical. He's thoughtful. He makes sense. He uses normal English. He speaks of anti-sensibilities that pervade the society, and he admits his art to be a gross oversimplification, which he employs more as style than as actuality. And he claims that, which is amazing, he claims that he doesn't really think that art can be oversimplified and remain art. He says it's got to have subtleties, and it's got to yield to an aesthetic unity. Otherwise, it's not art. And then you have Andy Warhol interviewed in 1964.
Andy, do you feel that the public has insulted your art?
No.
Why not?
I hadn't thought about it.
It doesn't bother you at all, then?
No.
Well, do you think that they've shown a lack of appreciation for what pop art means?
No.
Andy, do you think that pop art has sort of reached the point where it's becoming repetitious now?
Yes.
Do you think it should break away from being pop art?
No.
Are you just going to carry on?
Yes.
So the two artists clearly couldn't be more different. For Warhol, from the very outset, pop, you see, is a performance. While Lichtenstein can't imagine an artless world, Warhol embodies, he enacts, and he performs pop, relegating his objects, in this case the Brillo boxes, to the role of stage sets. Now let's look at an excerpt from a appearance that Salvador Dali made on What's My Line in 1952.
Lloyd, with that, let's begin the general questioning with Arlene Francis.
Are you associated with any of the arts?
Yes.
Would you ever have been seen on television?
Yes.
Are you a performer?
Yes.
Would you be considered a leading man?
Yes.
I got to move in here. Actually, in the general context of the questioning, we would have to accept that all the affirmative replies, except perhaps the last one, are not misleading in any major degree. However, I think the last answer is misleading, and we could not accurately describe our guest as a leading man.
He's a misleading man.
A misleading man he is. 1 down and 9 to go, Mr. Clerk.
Have you achieved eminence in some field other than television?
Yes.
Amazing, isn't it? That was 12 years before Warhol's skit. In Dolly's appearance, which Warhol must have seen, Warhol saw his path laid out in front of him. It wasn't just the binary yes-no format that Warhol cribbed so much from the show. It was the nature of the questions and the freeing responses given by Dolly that I believe he was inspired by. When asked, are you a performer? Dolly answers yes. Now, that is a very unusual answer for a painter, one who's typically spends solitary hours locked in a studio. They come out once every 2 years for an opening for a few hours, but one would not term a pre-Pollock painter as a performer. And, of course, Pollock's Hans Nemeth a film was later cast as painting as performance, but this is really before that was cast that way. So Dolly was the consummate performer. For his opening at the Julian Levy Gallery in New York City in 1938, he knew that for it to be a success, he had to make a scandal. Okay, so when he was asked to do these windows at Bonwit Teller on their Fifth Avenue store, Dolly found out that his design had been altered a little bit, and he got very incensed, and he summoned the media. He said, come in front of the windows. And when the whole media was gathered around, he took the bathtub that was part of the window display, and he just shoved it through the window, shattering glass all over Fifth Avenue, soaking everybody with water, and the resulting in his arrest in front of the cameras. And this is on your left. Here he is being taken to jail. And on the right, there's the window afterwards. The next night, he was let out of jail. His opening at the Levy Gallery was packed. The show sold out, and a leading man was born. And now when asked if he was a leading man, naturally, Dolly answers yes to the protests of the host, who obviously couldn't conceive of any person outside of the Hollywood star system as a leading man. But Dolly was already an international superstar, and he obviously thought of himself as such. And this is just the permission that Warhol was looking for. Even Dolly's eccentric persona with his famous mustache that he claimed to be an antenna to his muse, which was Eros. He always said that when it was erect, he was inspired, and at night it would droop down, he could no longer create. And he was never seen without his pet ocelot, which he lived in these very luxurious private hotel rooms for the remainder of his life, just him and his ocelot and his dear Gala. This was inspiring to Warhol, who latched onto the elder artist's full-blown, full-time assumption of role-playing. So from the day they donned them, neither Warhol nor Dolly ever broke from their public personas. And like Dolly, Warhol's persona was floated on a raft of material production, a ceaseless amount of objects of varying quality and dubious origin. While both men worked in a variety of mediums, Dolly made these incredible books. He directed films. He did ads for banks and so forth. In the end, the public still thought of Dolly and of Warhol as painters. And if they're remembered for anything else, it's for their eccentricity and for their personas. And in Warhol's case, his oeuvre can be recast as a lifelong quest of, again, what it means to be pop. Warhol conquers the world of pop to the point where back in the 1960s, on your left, he painted Elizabeth Taylor as a gushing fan. He wanted to get close to an unattainably huge star. But it was Elizabeth Taylor who, by the end of the 70s, when her star was waning, needed to stand next to Andy Warhol in order to receive his reflected light. So like a snake shedding skins, the different phases of his work are all an attempt to get close to this idea of pop. A simplified schema would be he's at the top of the heap of the commercial New York illustrating world in the 1950s. By the 60s, he drops out to become the most successful pop painter. In the late 60s, he stops painting to make only films. He wants to be accepted by Hollywood. He's rebuked by Hollywood. His dream is to get picked up by a studio. He has some meetings with them, and they tell him, you're just too weird, you know? So he just remains a cult filmmaker. That's not good enough for him. He's still not pop. So in the early 70s, he figures, what can I do? And he goes back to painting, but this time he starts focusing on those celebrity portraits, which become which bring the most cash and access to fame and power. He's getting close to pop now. He begins a magazine interview so that he can get commissions and more money and more power and more access. He would say to people, I mean, he had no sense of conflict of interest. He said, if you buy the most expensive portrait, I will put you on the cover of Interview magazine. He promised everybody a cover. Of course, only the real celebrities got them. By the mid-70s, though, the paintings become less important, and he realizes he's got to get bigger. So he goes into media, nightclubs, celebrity, and then he really does become close to pop. And by the end of his life in the 80s, he is now the world's most famous artist. And he, at the end of his life, becomes a Zolli model, displayed on the runway, the apex of pop, himself displayed as a runway model. So where Lichtenstein was a pop painter, Warhol was pop. When in the mid to late 60s, Warhol claims he's not making paintings anymore so he can focus on his films, the demand for them then goes through the roof. As such, Warhol enacts, or perhaps even inspires, Guy Debord's definition that spectacle is capital to such a degree of accumulation that it becomes an image. In a Barthian sense, the author is dead. Andy Warhol, the author, is dead, but the corpse, which is the physical embodiment of the work, is still on display as it is upstairs for paying customers. Warhol's brilliant strategy was to move in both directions, at once widely democratic, anyone can do what I do, and restrictively exclusive, but not everyone can buy what I do. In the mid-60s, the spirit then infuses everything he comes into contact with. Once he gives up painting, everything is art if he says it's art. The breakdown between life and art is complete, and a gesture as simple as eating a hamburger becomes completely Warholian. This is a film by the Danish filmmaker Jürgen Leth from 1982.
Thank you. name is Andy Warhol, and I just finished eating a hamburger.
It's so fascinating. It's such a complicated piece because particularly the last part refers, you know, very much to his three-minute screen test where he puts somebody in front of a camera and just makes them sit there for 3 minutes. It also refers to the wonderful short film that he did in 1965, two versions of the drag queen Mario Montez seductively eating a banana, and also refers to the 1966 45-minute epic film of the pop artist Robert Indiana eating a mushroom, one mushroom he takes 45 minutes to eat. And so it's I think it's a very, very smart picture. And of course, it's completely Warholian. I say this is as Warholian as any painting Andy ever made, maybe more so. Similarly, this is a very short ad that he did in the 1980s for TDK.
Aka, Midori, Ao, Gunjo Iro, Kyudei,
Imagine wo shigeki suru color hi-fi, DDK videotape.
So what's incredible about that is, you know, I mean, any spokesperson, you know, could have done that ad, but Warhol and his presence and the way he's holding a blank screen and saying these sort of, you know, repeating these things that he's supposed to say becomes insanely Warholian. It's really profound that everything that he touches becomes that. Now, but living pop was not easy. Because like real pop, it was ugly, and it was brutal, and it was cheap, and shallow, and depressing, and hollow. And as much as Warhol claimed to get out of it, that's how much was taken out of him. Suicides, drug casualties, two assassination attempts on his life, numerous jealousies, more death threats, just like a pop star. In the end, it was a tremendous sacrifice to make for a set of complex philosophical propositions that only could be wrapped in the guise of pop. It was the sheer fantasy, again, it's all fantasy. The fantasy world of pop made it possible for Warhol to create a fantasy environment in which to test his outrageous experiments in morality and ethics. Because if anything, Warhol was amoral and aethical, not un, but a. And by stepping outside of the logocentric culture into this weightless world, one devoid of any consequences where anything was possible, it's only art that would permit him to play out these ideas with 100% commitment to a journey that was truly lifelong. By invoking the normally antisocial criminal acts of impersonation, fraudulence, identity fraud, he was able to gradually eradicate and detach himself from his own work, realizing, and this was so smart, he realized that a dependence on autobiography on Andy Warhol would limit the shelf life of his work. So what did he do? He spent the rest of his life trying to dematerialize himself in the service of distribution and posterity. He also knew that through absence, what becomes lost becomes more ever-present and ubiquitous, morphing, of course, into the iconic. And you just have to think of the silver screen, or Elvis, or the Twin Towers. Warhol's career leaves a legacy of authorized impersonations. Most famously, when in the fall of 1969, factory denizen and seasoned actor Alan Majette was hired by Warhol to do a series of college lectures impersonating Andy himself. This is a picture of Alan Majette during this period on a college tour being Andy Warhol. Now, Warhol found it difficult and really tedious to do these engagements. And the students were disappointed too when they were expecting somebody dynamic and glamorous. Tight-lipped and sly Warhol appeared. He wouldn't talk. So he said to Majette, "You're on the other hand, you know, charismatically don my silver wig and put on my sunglasses," and he was a smash hit with the students. And the stunt went off without a hitch for a long time, but the gig finally ended when a suspicious newspaper reporter called the factory and Warhol was forced to spill the beans. And then Andy Warhol, as himself, subsequently had to return to the colleges to make up for those impersonations. He didn't want to talk. It was easier to let others do it for him. In a 1966 television interview, Warhol reluctantly answered questions fired at him by an aggressive and skeptical off-scene interlocutor. Now you have to picture in your mind Warhol, again, tight-lipped, really tense, sitting on a stool in front of a silver Elvis painting, and the camera is zooming back and forth on Warhol's face, just like this, framed by these sunglasses, which actually are broken. And his fingers are like covering his lips like this, and he mumbles, and he stutters, and he's hesitant, and you can barely hear what he says. And so Warhol is just sitting there staring at the camera like the end of the hamburger thing, and he says, finally, I mean, you should just tell me the words, and I'll just repeat them, because I can't, I'm so empty today, I can't think of anything. Why don't you just tell me the words, and they'll come out of my mouth? And so the interviewer says, no, really. And Warhol says, no, really, it would be nice. And then the interviewer, who's just really freaked out at this point, says, hey, don't worry, Andy, you'll loosen up after a while. Wrong thing to say. Warhol says, well, no, it's not that. It's just that I can't, I have a cold, and I can't think of anything. It would be so nice if you told me a sentence and I could just repeat it. And then the interviewer comes back to him again. He says, no, look, just let me ask you a question and you can answer it. And he says, no, but you have to repeat the answers too. And so we see this being enacted in this amazing 1969, this very short clip from Emile D'Antonio's documentary Painter's Painting, where he has factory denizen Bridget Berlin ventriloquize
his words for him. All people are the same.
Oops, sorry.
And that you wanted to be a machine in your painting. Is that true?
Is it true, Bridget?
No, he just wishes it was all easier. He said to me last week on the phone, he said, Bridget, wouldn't it be nice if in the morning we could get up and at 10 o'clock go to all the movies and then all the galleries and just think it would be just like Teenie and Marcel used to do, you know? Like, then how would you get any art done? Now, Andy can do that, but I can't because, you know, I've got to do my painting and my books.
Your hair.
Get to my hair, sit under the dryer. That's a great art, to come out with dry hair.
Pop started doing them 6 or 7 years ago before Bridget did them. I mean, could you tell me the whole process? I mean, tell me about the electric chair, which is one of my favorite paintings by anybody.
Well, I just found a picture and gave it to the man, and he made a print, and then I just took it and then just began printing.
And he made a silk screen print?
He made a silk screen print, yeah. And then they came out all different because I guess I didn't know how to really screen. But Bridget does all my paintings, but she doesn't know anything about them.
Well, I know what's good. I know what's good.
What do you mean Bridget does all your paintings?
Well, Bridget's been doing my paintings for the last 3 years.
How does she do them?
Well, I haven't done any work in the last 3 years.
Well, you see, I just call Mr. Golden, and I just tell him the colors. And I take Polaroids of the four flowers, and I switch the colors around and superimpose four cutout ones up on top of it. Take a picture and have Mr. Golden do it.
But Mr. Golden's dead.
No, but it's the sun.
Oh.
So those flowers up in the galleries here are actually not made by Andy Warhol, but they were made by Bridget Berlin. They're fakes. His grip on disinformation is remarkable. In a collection of statements gathered for the 1980 retrospective Picasso at the MoMA, a number of artists were asked what they thought about Picasso, and the painter Paul Jenkins was of the opinion that the dominant feature of the work is the distortion of the classical, which eventually becomes the classical itself. And the prominent African-American artist Romare Bearden explains that Picasso remained a very Spanish painter, and our friend Roy Lichtenstein says, I think of Picasso as one of the most important artists of the 20th century. Warhol, avoiding such weighty art historical pronouncement, offered this. The only thing I can really relate to is his daughter, Paloma. She's wonderful. Do you know her at all? She comes to town. Maybe you should interview her sometime. She comes here every other week. I'm just glad he had a wonderful daughter like Paloma. And then he goes after his rival, pop artist Jasper Johns, in this interview in 1971.
What do you think of Jasper Johns? Why?
He makes such great lunches.
Okay. And the next sentence, which really isn't on that clip, is he says he does this great thing with chicken. He puts parsley inside the chicken. I mean, he's talking about Jasper Johns. And while it may be true that Johns was a terrific cook, Warhol's description of his chicken recipe was, needless to say, not the kind of information that an art critic was seeking. And it was really meant just to throw her off the trail. So by removing himself, he becomes more forceful by throwing a focus onto the margins and the peripheral. He proposes a new way of thinking. Wait, what if stuffing a chicken with parsley means just as much as making a $1 million flag painting? We can extend this to say, what if cooking is more significant than artistic achievement? What if daily life triumphs art? The implications in Warhol's joking are very, very profound. Even the management of his career fell under the spell. Once he asked how he dealt with a bad review, he said, I don't read what they write about me. I just measure it in inches. He said, I don't read anything that's written about me. I just look at the pictures and the articles. It doesn't matter what they say about me. I just read the textures of the words. And that's very radical. By proposing that words, I mean the real material of our humanity, of our communication, the raw material, can be envisioned not as communicative devices or to be read, but as material to be moved, quantified, measured, and weighed, he anticipates today's widespread phenomenon of what Terry had mentioned earlier, unoriginal genius or uncreativity. This is a recent phrase coined by the prominent literary critic Marjorie Perloff, and her idea is that due to changes brought on by technology and the internet, our notion of genius, a romantic, isolated figure, is outdated. An updated notion of genius would have to center around one's mastery of information and its dissemination. Perloff has actually coined a term, moving information, to signify both the act of pushing language around as well as the act of being emotionally moved by that language. She posits that today's artist, like Warhol, resembles more a programmer than a tortured genius, brilliantly conceptualizing, constructing, executing, and maintaining an art machine. And Warhol's entire oeuvre then was based on the idea of uncreativity, the seemingly effortless production of mechanical paintings and unwatchable films where literally nothing happens. And in terms of his literary practice too, it was really absolutely amazing. Most people don't know that Warhol wrote a dozen books, but of course he didn't write any of them. He had other people write his books for him, yet the covers bore his name as author. He creates new genres of literature. This is his great novel from 1968. It's just a transcription of dozens of cassette tapes. Spelling errors and stumbles were left by the typists that did it. He didn't even bother to proofread it. The words become like the errors in his silkscreens. He wants the inconsistency with language. He wants the errors. Don't make it right. Do it wrong. His diaries, which spent weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, were spoken to an assistant over the phone and transcribed. In Perloffian terms, then, Warhol was an unoriginal genius, one who was able to create a profoundly original body of work by being unoriginal, by isolating, reframing, recycling, regurgitating, and endlessly reproducing ideas and images that weren't his. Yet by the time he was finished with him, they were completely Warholian. By mastering the manipulation of information, Warhol understood that he could master culture. Now, this is very important because Warhol reminds us that to be the originator of something widely memed, the word meme comes from the Greek word memeia, meaning something imitated, this today can match being the originator of the trigger event. Those re-gestures, such as reblogging and retweeting, have become cultural rites of cachet in and of themselves. Sorting and filtering moving information has become a site of cultural capital. Filtering is taste, and good taste rules the day. Andy Warhol's exquisite sensibility, combined with his finely tuned taste, challenged the locus of artistic production from creator to mediator. And so we find ourselves in the present. Our world, as often has been said, turned out to be exactly the way Andy predicted it. The meme, the internet meme, predicts that everybody would be famous for 15 minutes. I'm going to move through this and finish up now. just to say that that value is not in the unique, but in the multiple and the moving and hoarding information today. Warhol was a famous hoarder. He hoarded, say, cookie jars the way we hoard MP3s, stuffing our hard drives with more than we'll ever be able to listen to, downloading and archiving as the ultimate form of consumerism, the idea of possessing something without ever having to use it. Now, Warhol anticipates this with this image here. This is a masterwork that I feel is a masterwork called The Time Capsules. He never posited these as artworks, and I think very few people think of them as such, but I feel they're the most important work that he did. Beginning in 1973 and continuing until the end of his life, he kept an open box in his studio, and he tossed into it whatever came his way, from envelopes containing $17,000 in cash, to nude photos of Jackie O, to a mummified human foot belonging to an ancient Egyptian, to 45 RPM test pressings of Ramones records signed by Joey Ramone, to McDonald's wrappers, to envelopes, to napkins. And once the box would get filled, and they'd get filled very quickly in Warhol's studio, he would tape them, and then he would sign them, and he would number them, and then send them off to New Jersey, where they were stored. And by the time he died, there were over 600 of them. And today, they're at the Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh, but only a few have been opened. Because due to the fact that each time one is open, it takes three people, and you see them doing one here, nobody knows what's inside these things. But there's also every manner of crap is inside of them. It's a three-person job with each object, because these are all works of art, every single object in there, from a tissue to a sheet of paper, needs to get a catalog number, needs to be photographed, needs to be entered into the database. It takes the three people working 2 months to do one box. As a result, dozens remain sealed to this day. We'll never, ever know really what's in those boxes. There's 575 left to go. And it's amazing, you know. It's so beautiful. To me, this is better than anything that's in the galleries. And so we could say that the web and our burgeoning data cloud, then, is our collective time capsule, so vast and so unknowable that it really dwarfs one man's work in terms of the time capsules. In his last decade, Warhol worked furiously in all directions. He hosted two cable television shows. He continued his work with Interview. He pioneered new technologies. He was one of the first artists to work with Amiga and to do digital art. Here he is doing a public demonstration of this, making a portrait of Debbie Harry. He actually got on the cover of Amiga World, a geek magazine. He spent a lot of time working with the Rolling Stones, of course, doing... sets for them. Here you see that he did the cover for Love You Live. He did the cover for Some Girls. He did the cover for Sticky Fingers. He produced musical acts. This is awful. This is a guy from the 1980s who went nowhere, a talentless guy from his studio. Then he wasn't always right, but he did it. This is a guy named Walter Stedding, who nobody's ever heard of. And he was talentless. But Warhol put these funny glasses on him and put him up on a stage hoping that he would become the new Velvet Underground. In fact, you know, it really does take talent. Lou Reed has talent. And there's a reason why the Velvet Underground are so famous, and Walter Stedding absolutely went nowhere. But the point is, he was still doing it, you know? And of course, he was making objects. And my feeling is that his most profound paintings of the period explore ephemeral phenomena, most notably his Shadow series, which were created around the same time as his ill-fated Whitney. So sure, while he's doing these terrible portraits of celebrities, he's also making sublime works that, of course, this is a shot from the installation at the Dia. There were 200 of these, and they're just shadows. But Warhol didn't want to deal with their sublimity. He instead referred to these shadow paintings as disco decor. In fact, they were used as a backdrop at a fashion shoot. In Interview, he thought models looked great in front of them. He didn't want to talk about them. So near the end of his life, he took dematerialization to new extremes. He dematerializes himself. He's out in the networks. Everything is becoming virtual and viral. He creates two versions of what he calls invisible sculptures. One, which there is no photograph of, consisted of a series of burglar alarms that were aimed in the center of his studio. He just set it up. And as soon as anybody walked into the room, all these, you know, the light beams would get broken and sounds would go off, chirping and booming and buzzing. And it was a sound sculpture. It was a light sculpture. It was a conceptual work. Fittingly, he didn't bother documenting it. And the second invisible sculpture is the piece that we're looking at here that was created for one night only in 1985 at a downtown nightclub where he displays this empty pedestal and this wall tag that says Andy Warhol, USA, invisible sculpture, mixed media, 1985. And for the better part of the evening in the club area, he just stood next to it on display as a living work of art. I think really his most truthful work of art. The epitome of his life exploration into what it means to be pop culminated with himself, as I said before, on display as a runway model just 5 days before his death on February 17th, 1987, for Zoli at the nightclub called The Tunnel. And he walked down the runway with Miles Davis. And this is just amazing because this is the last very moving video. This is the last video ever taken of Andy Warhol, and fittingly, he himself is on display as a runway model for the very last shot of Andy Warhol. Andy wasn't pleased with his performance. He wrote in his diaries that he complained they did a $5,000 custom outfit for Miles with gold musical notes on it and everything, and they didn't do a thing for me. They were so mean. They could have made me a gold palette or something, so I looked like the poor stepchild. In the end, they told me I even walked too slow. Of course, though, that great last shot, the last footage of Warhol, it's just so moving and so incredible. There's Warhol on the runway with the camera, the device of reflection, refraction, reproduction, surveillance, and capture. He points the camera back at himself, back at the audience. There he is, half man, half machine, a living mirror. An interviewer says to Andy Warhol, "Do you look at yourself in the mirror?" And Andy says, "No, it's too hard to look in the mirror. Nothing's there." And so I guess that in closing, when you're looking at the exhibition here at the museum, you need to keep in mind, really, that what you're seeing is a fraction of the artist that Andy Warhol was. By no means the entirety of what he did. It's a slice of all that he was involved with, and I think it's best not to judge the period solely what's hanging on the walls, for what's hanging on the walls is merely the corpse. The spirit of Warhol's last decade is flowing through our culture, on the airwaves, and infusing the lifeblood of our social networks. Ladies and gentlemen, Andy Warhol has left the building. Thank you. Thanks so much. If anybody has a question, I'm glad to answer it. Yeah.
You made the comment that money was his driving force, but just looking at the work from his last decade, I mean, there seems to be so much more.
Yeah. Well, it's always yes and no with Andy. Yes, it was, but no, it wasn't. I mean, but sorry? No, no, it doesn't help. Nothing helps. You know, logic doesn't apply to Warhol. Every time you say something, the opposite is also right. This is why he's so fascinating. He's like a greased cylinder. You just, every angle, you just keep bouncing off and reflecting, or a prism. You just can't get a grip on him. And this is the paradox. And this is why we still care about him. And really, in a way, like why we don't care so much about Salvador Dali. He was one-dimensional by comparison to Warhol. We still can't figure it out. Just what, you know. So the answer is yes and no, and I think it's a very good observation. Now, that probably kills any other question, you know. Yes, in the back, yeah.
There was that interview in Tanner's painting where the woman that was sort of speaking for him says, reports that he had said to her, that, you know, wouldn't it be nice to be like Tini and Marcel, like just going to the movies instead of having to go to work? And I thought it was really interesting because it was, you know, just to reference Tini's, you know, very sort of historical detail that one would have to have intimate knowledge of in terms of Marcel Duchamp.
Yeah, but Warhol hung out with Duchamp.
He was at the factory. Warhol did portraits of Duchamp. Warhol did a screen test of Duchamp. Yeah, you know, and he socialized with them.
So how much do you think he modeled himself on Warhol, his idea of persona?
How much Duchamp did?
How much Warhol modeled himself on Duchamp, oh. You know, who also was a very sort of complex...
Duchamp wasn't into showbiz. Duchamp was into art world, and Duchamp also was into vanishing. You have to remember the period in the 60s, the silence of Marcel Duchamp is overrated. People used to wear buttons saying the silence of Marcel Duchamp is overrated. And of course, the big joke on all of us was he just became a chess player, a respiratoire. But in the end of the day, of course, he was working every day furiously to make Etant Donnée. So I think it's similar, but I also think it's really different. I think actually the self-promotion of Dali, Warhol, I mean, Duchamp really wanted to fade out, whereas Warhol wanted to both fade out and be front and center.
Terry?
Do you think, though, that perhaps he modeled his contrariness on Duchamp, because that would be the comparison that I think would be valid, is that Duchamp had a way of the answers both yes and no.
I think so. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's hard to say. He in the literature around Warhol, there's very little mention of Duchamp, almost none. So it's really hard to know what he knew and what he didn't. I mean, he didn't. Maybe it was so profound that he refused to talk about Duchamp. Cage, that was going to show a really great clip from Cage on I've Got a Secret, another 50s game show where Cage is also front and center. Cage had much more of a knack for self-promotion, but stayed very high, where Warhol went high and low at the same time. So now he never mentions Duchamp ever. So it might be too close, might be uncomfortably close. I think you're probably onto something. Yeah.
Say a follow-up of that. Duchamp or Warhol does purposely go to California when he has his second show at the Ferris Gallery to see the Duchamp retrospective and meet Duchamp.
Absolutely.
And that's a huge thing for
him. Yeah, you're right. That's true. He does go there.
Yeah.
And he's showing the Death and Disaster series, which is a disaster, real disaster. Nothing sells. After the Campbell soup cans went nuts, nothing sold there. So that's right, they do. They get in the car and they go to Pasadena for Duchamp's retrospective, but he doesn't really ever talk about it. But it's clear he idolizes it. And Dennis Hopper's also the connection between Duchamp and Warhol. Can you imagine that dinner party? Really? Isn't that incredible? Okay. So thank you so much for coming in. And do take the show with a grain of salt upstairs, I think. Okay, thank you very much.